in 3, 2, 1. Hi, this is Tim Grierson.
Hey, and this is Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Unleashed podcast, episode 21.
Blackjack!
happy to be on episode 21. Our podcast is now old enough to drink, and we are celebrating by... I'm having the typical wine spritzers that I have during this podcast every week. What are you drinking, Grierson?
I'm enjoying a Cabernet.
Oh, that's good. That's good. But no fucking Merlot.
That's right. Reference to the popular film Sideways.
It wasn't that popular.
Yeah, popular enough.
All right, so welcome back. This is the Grierson Podcast. As always, please make sure to follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Find our work at newrepublic.com. And, of course, please subscribe to us on iTunes and SoundCloud. And give us a nice review on iTunes if you do that and list the name of a movie. We will include you in our reboot section. This week, we have two reboot movies. The first movie comes to us from JBTHUBE or Jebthoop. He says, good companion to reviews. I read their reviews and enjoy them. If you like the reviews, this is a nice companion for when driving, etc. Of course, make sure to use a hand-free device and keep both of your hands on the wheel. So far, I think they are still finding their footing. Again, February, our feet.
Totally found. We found
totally it. Found. It was really awkward for a couple of months there. But I really like the way they think about movies, so I'm excited to hear where it goes. I hope they discuss Menace to Society. So today we're going to be talking in our first reboot segment about the Hughes Brothers Menace to Society. Our second reboot movie comes to us from May. The review is from May 18th from Bodyguard Koi Koi, which is, again, I don't even know what that's from, but it sounds great. 5 stars, great stuff! Exclamation point. The only movie pod on iTunes that's both smart and lighthearted with some good debate and on-point conversation. Hosts have a wide range of movie knowledge and good taste, most of the time winking emoticon. Please discuss Being John Malkovich for the reboot section. I think it's one of the smarter comedies ever made, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts. Well, Bodyguard Koi Koi, your interest is about to be sated because we're going to talk about Being John Malkovich. But first, before we get to our big movie of the week, I want to kind of tease something that we're doing at the end of June. Every year, I think we've been doing this since we started doing on Yahoo, right? I think Yahoo's when we started this, right, Grierson? Of doing our midway year?
Either Yahoo or when we started Deadspin, one or the other, but yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know if you realize this, but time is progressing at a frighteningly rapid rate. And at the end of this month, in about 2 weeks, we will be at the halfway point of 2016. Now, everyone, of course, always likes to put together their top 10 list at the end of the year. But oftentimes that means you forget often, including the Academy Awards is very famous for doing this, for forgetting some of the great movies from the first half of the year. So every year, Grierson and I, each of us do our top 6 movies. So it's like half of 12 of 10, but like one more than that. Our top 6 movies from the first half of the year. So what we ask for you to do is to hit us up on Twitter at Grierson Leach and tell us a movie that we may have missed, that we make sure that a movie that you think if we've not seen, we need to make sure to catch from the first half of the year. And we're going to have a whole podcast where we talk about our top movies of the year. But a movie that we did see, so you do not need to mention, is Warcraft. So Grierson, let's talk about Warcraft.
Side with the humans against your own kind.
This is suicide.
We have no choice. We should attack with full force.
Whatever you plan to do, do it now!
When the summer movie calendar came out, and we're talking about movies we were looking forward to, I don't think either Will or I were necessarily excited about Warcraft, but there was one thing that made us think, I don't know, maybe this could be good. And the reason was director Duncan Jones, who made his debut film was Moon with Sam Rockwell from a few years ago. He then went on to make Source Code, and now his third film is Warcraft, and there's no beating around the bush. This is the worst thing I've seen this year, and I'm pretty sure it's going to be the worst thing. A few weeks ago, I may have said that if I saw something worse than Alice Through the Looking Glass, I'd be very depressed. Well,
and then a week later,
depression has come. Warcraft is absolutely terrible. It is based on the series of Blizzard Entertainment Warcraft games, and it's kind of an origin story of sorts about how the humans and the orcs first came into conflict. The way it works is that the orc planet has been destroyed, and they need a new planet to reside on. Using some sort of space portal, I don't care about the science of how it works. They go to the lush, lovely, kind of medieval-looking planet where the humans live, and they invade there to take over the planet. So it becomes humans versus orcs.
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 I like the Lord of the Rings movies. I like a old-fashioned, somewhat tongue-in-cheek homage to kind of crappy old fantasy movies, which I think in some ways Duncan Jones is actually trying to do. I think Warcraft is, it wants to be a throwback old-school fantasy film. I think it wants to be sort of a big Lord of the Rings-style action movie, war movie kind of thing. It is, in some ways for me, very difficult to encapsulate a film that every creative decision made me either angry or apoplectic or just confused and depressed. I mean, you can start a litany of what goes wrong in this movie. I think the first one I want to talk about is Paula Patton. Paula Patton, who is quite a fun actress, quite a good actress. She was one of the best things in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. She plays a half-human, half-orc who is captured by the humans early on during one of the big battle scenes and is essentially domesticated, which forces Paula Patton to be in the unenviable role of being a kind of like a savage-like orc who has to act like a savage during most of the movie and like grunt all of her lines and has pointy teeth for her character as part of her ungodly makeup,
but as not pointy to show that she's not all orc. It's not as pointy as everyone else.
Yes, so she looks mostly human, but, and this is an exaggeration, but not that much of an exaggeration, she talk them like this and does not understand things. It's hard to, you know, we talk about like, you know, like maybe say cringe comedy, like say Curb Your Enthusiasm, where the idea is like, oh, I can't look because what Larry David is doing is so uncomfortable. This is like cringe fantasy action, because every time Paula Patton's on screen, I was cringing in my seat, feeling so terrible for her. But that said, I feel like most of the actors in this movie are not well served at all. It's a type of movie where it was just slightly more fun. You might be fooled into thinking, oh, well, they're just kind of having, they're kind of poking fun at certain conventions and kind of the earnestness of this type of fairy tale kind of movie. Nope. The effects and the sort of the CG work and the motion capture used to create the orcs. I mean, again, do the orcs look good in the motion capture? I suppose. I guess this is good work, but they are so like ugly in terms of how they are rendered, it's actually painful to watch them. I saw this in 3D IMAX. It's slightly immersive. You do feel like you are transported to another planet, but very much the way that we talked about with Jungle Book, where I kind of complained about the fact that, yeah, I guess Jungle Book is really impressively well done, but I didn't care about anything. That goes triple, quadruple for this movie. From beginning to end, I found it to be such a slog, and contained actors like Ben Foster, who I normally like, who are so joyless and so unfun to watch. I don't play the video game. I don't think that matters. I found this absolutely dreadful.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible. And I have a couple things I kind of want to get into about it. One is almost an existential question, which is this movie, I like, it's bad, but I also, frankly, literally could not follow what was going on. And I mean that in like a fundamental sense of, you know, we've talked about in the comic book movies about how they have so many masters to serve and they have so many things they have to do and they have the loyal fan base. This is a movie in a lot of ways that if you have not played the game, and I've not played the game, though I, from what I understand, it's not particularly a poorly regarded game.
No, it's not. Yeah.
But if you've not played the game, the movie does not ever feel like obliged to justify why there is a movie out of this. It's just, the movie is just off and running. And, you know, we've talked about how filmmakers, we like it when they trust the audience to catch up with what's going on. If they don't understand, they'll get there. That's one of the things we regularly praise movies on this podcast about. This movie is long gone before I can even, like, this movie is just off and I wouldn't say running, but sort of like stumbling around. And And I wondered if I had played the game, would I understand this? Would I have some clue? Would I be invested? Would it fill in all these big, huge gaps that I don't understand? And it just got me thinking, like, well, if movies only need to appeal to a certain anymore, just a certain hardcore video game fan or so on, and don't need to appeal to anyone that doesn't know anything, why, like, maybe this is just, they're all going to go this way. Maybe eventually all movies are just going to be niche like every other media anymore. Like, they not only is, we always talk about, like, maybe this movie's just not for me, but, like, this movie in a lot of ways just felt like literally not for anyone that wasn't into this already, which brings me to my next idea on this, which is not only does everybody look so unhappy, but you sense their embarrassment. You sense they're like, oh, I got to get out of this thing. And to me, Paula Patton and Ben Foster, they have tougher jobs than those, because Dominic Cooper and Ruth Negga clearly are like, we're just going to be back here with the drapes. Okay. Like, just right. Don't, like, maybe you don't notice this. Maybe you won't see this. But, like, Ben Foster and Paula Patton are right at the foremost, and just like, I felt so bad for both of them. Like, Ben Foster's a good actor, man. Like, he's a good actor, and he is a disaster in this movie.
Yeah, it plays to his worst tendencies, which is that he likes to play the crazy guy or the intense guy or the intentionally complicated or unlovable character. That's kind of what he gravitates to. And I think I agree. I think he's a great actor. But this is the type of thing where it's like, without a certain amount of structure, he just sort of implodes within himself. I would also add that Toby Kebbell, one of the main orcs, the idea behind, you know, one of the main story ideas is that the orcs want to invade this planet and colonize it, but not all the orcs are evil per se. And Toby Kebbell plays one of the orcs who's much more of a noble kind of character. He is one of the central figures in the Rise of the Planet of the Apes and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. He's like the main evil bad ape in those movies. And I know that we don't feel the same way about that franchise, but you look at what that series does in terms of being somber and serious and thoughtful, and in some ways they touch on socially relevant topics while having a ton of CG and motion capture. I'm a bigger fan, but nonetheless, those movies are masterpieces in comparison to, because with this, it's like, are they bored? Do they look depressed? Or is this the idea of being solemn in a movie does not equal significance? If you ask me, gun to my head, the idea behind Warcraft is, number one, protecting the environment. And then number two, this idea of, you know, different groups of people have to learn to live together and that war is not the answer. But you watch that movie and you think, oh, it's just about being glum for glum's sake. Will and I are not opposed to blockbusters. We are not opposed to summer movies. We like a lot of them. But this movie, to me, represents everything that is wrong with what's going on with blockbuster movies. Number one, there's so much CG that it loses any sense of wonder, any sense of joy. It's just so mechanical and boring. And then number two, I don't know what they were thinking. This movie has a lead-in to a sequel, to a follow-up film. You watch the film, and this movie is over 2 hours long with end credits. You watch this movie, you suffer through this film, and then you think, wait, this was all set up for the next movie? There is such a betrayal, I feel like, as an audience member going, you know what, screw you. Like, I've sat through this, and this was terrible. I'm not watching another one of these. I don't care what happens next. I'm never going to see another one of these Warcraft movies. And to answer your question, this movie had a record-breaking gross in China. It's a huge hit in China, and so now the worry is it might tank in the U.S., and they'll still make another one anyway.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I'd like to note, by the way, that, as a personal thing about this movie, I did not go to the actual screening of this, so I had to see it on a Thursday, which happens sometimes. Sometimes I'm unable to make a screening. Originally, I was going to see this at 8 o'clock in Atlanta. And then I realized, oh, I'm going to get out of this interview quicker. I'll go ahead and see it at 7 in Atlanta. So I bought tickets to both. And then I realized the interview got done such quicker that I realized, oh, I can drive all the way back to my home in Athens. So then I bought a ticket for the 7 o'clock movie in Athens. So I literally have given like $45 to this movie, this horrible, terrible nightmare disaster of a movie. I gave it like $45.
Wow.
So if there is a sequel, I actually have to take my fair share of responsibility.
I'm going yeah. to, I will bring that up at some future time.
Yeah.
And also because I start off by talking about Duncan Jones. You know,
I'd like to finish on him. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is a slight idea of a visual sense for this movie. Yeah, this type of movie that if you saw like a test screening against guests and you didn't know who the director was, there'd be sort of this gasp of like, oh no, it's Duncan Jones? You know, like how... Sam Adams has a great piece at IndieWire about the fact that, you know, there used to be a time of the one for them, one for me mode. And for people who are not familiar with that term, it's the idea of, well, as a filmmaker, I will... you know, make your big Hollywood blockbuster, but in exchange, I'll make more of a personal project because I have the clout to be able to do that. And that's a well-worn idea in the business. And you watch a movie like this and you think, if Duncan Jones's soul has not been destroyed by this thing, maybe he can make a project for himself. But it's hard to look at a movie like this and think, oh, well, this is definitely a great piece of craftsmanship. Or you could see, oh, this is a great filmmaker working it. He just gets destroyed by this, you know, this monstrosity of this movie. I really can't express enough how much I hated this movie. Like, I actually walked out angry after sitting through this thing. So
what'd you give it? Because it's funny, because like, I'm going to give my letter grade first, because I actually did the New Republic review. I gave it a D, and I... I got two responses, mainly, by the way. I got two major responses from people. One was the typical question we get when we give a movie a D after a really review that trashes it, which is like, how is that not an F? Why didn't you give it an F? And we always explain to people, well, an F requires like something like morally reprehensible.
Right.
Or, yes. Where you just feel like, oh, wow, this is like, I feel like the actors in this movie should be like, helicoptered out and rescued and maybe they've been degraded for life. But of course the other response was people Warcraft video game fans claiming that I had been paid to spread lies about Warcraft movie, which is a new development in the critic world. When you get into these video game movies and comic book movies, people just assume that the rival video game or comic book company, I don't know actually who is paying for that, but yeah, so it's a full on D. Did this get lower than that to you, or is it just a straight D for you?
I just love, by the way, that you paid $45 for that lucrative paycheck that you were getting for.
Seriously, there's no way I came out ahead on this movie. Even if I had gotten paid, there's no way they would have paid me more than $45.
I remember with the Alice Through the Looking Glass, we sort of talked about it, like where the D or the D minus or the F, where those demarcations are. And believe you me, I sat through about an hour during this movie going, is this an F? Is this an F? It is an F. I gave it an F.
Oh,
I agree, and we've talked about this, that the morally reprehensible thing usually is, that's the trigger. I decided to be generous with this movie and also give it an F. I just think it's atrocious. Just atrocious. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I have to say, this is kind of special. I'd be lying if I didn't say I'm kind of aroused right now, Chris, and I'm pretty excited.
So you see, your $45 were not spent in vain.
Oh, man.
So you can at least go, I can see where Tim is coming from, but boy. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Well, so Warcraft, get out there and
don't see it. Yeah.
Please do anything other than that. Is it too late now to say sorry? Yeah, I know that I let you down. Is it too late to say sorry now? I'm sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. All right. Okay, now it's time for our reboot section. I feel like I got to take a nap after that one, Grierson. That would wore me out.
That's been building up for a few days.
Yeah, you were ready to go.
I needed to let that out. So thank you, listener, for listening to that. Yes.
Well, let's talk about a couple of movies that are a lot better than that. We'll start off with we're going to do our reboot section. We're going to start out first with Menace to Society.
Being a black man in America isn't easy. All I'm saying is, survive.
You need to be glad that you graduated from high school and that you're alive at 18. And you need to do something with yourself before you end up like he did.
I'm not gonna end up like he did, all right?
Menace to Society came out in 1993. It is directed by the Hughes brothers, written by Tiger Williams, who, I believe it, if I remember correctly, in a Grantland piece, didn't sell another script. I think he sold a script. I don't think he had another movie made for like 22 years after this, which is, you know, that's nice. Stars Tyron Taylor, Lawrence Tate, Jada Pinkett, before she was Jada Pinkett Smith, Charles Sutton, very briefly, Samuel L. Jackson, and that came out in 1993, so it was certainly right around the time, on the heels of Boys in the Hood, this is the type of movie that could be made. I believe it was New Line. It was New Line Studios that did this, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, so this was around the time where New Line, while not a Warner Brothers major studio, this was a relatively well-financed and certainly well-reviewed and even somewhat relatively financially successful movie that came out in 1993. Now, Grierson, I think we saw this in the theater together.
We actually did not.
Okay,
because it
okay.
came out in May of 93.
Oh, so it's right when we were graduating.
We both had graduated from high school around that time. I just saw it in college. You know, it's important also in terms of context. You know, we talked about O.J. Made in America last week. You know, this is it's set in South Central. It comes out around the time of the Rodney King riots, and so it's kind of perfectly timed in terms of what's going on in that city at that time.
It's also, and remember the ad, the tagline for this movie is, "This is the truth, this is what's real."
Yes.
Like that, if that gives you an idea of the way this movie was being marketed and kind of the cultural moment that it was that happened with it.
I have not seen Menace to Society in its entirety since 1993 and really, really love this movie. It was much more different of an experience watching it this time.
I agree.
You know, it is very much a movie that feels indebted, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's definitely influenced by the films of Scorsese. It's definitely a movie made by people who've seen Mean Streets a lot, who've seen Goodfellas a lot, and are very much kind of telling that kind of story of a young, impressionable, not necessarily, I wouldn't say unsympathetic main character, but someone who is supposed to seem blasé about the world in which he lives. Tyron Turner plays this guy who's nicknamed Kane, short for cocaine. He's sort of a casual drug dealer, goes to high school, but doesn't really care that much about high school. And he just lives in a world where gangs are everywhere and it's not a shock to him. Friends of his have been killed. Friends of his are in jail. That's just the way his world operates. There is no surprise for him. And he tells his story through a voiceover narration that's meant to be kind of steely and cold-eyed and unpassionate and not really romantic either. It's just sort of, he's sort of telling it like it is. Watching it this time, well, let me say this. It is very difficult to watch this movie as a 41-year-old person, who's also white, of course, but to watch
still,
this movie, it still hasn't changed, and not to think this is made by very young people. I think that the movie ultimately still works because I think that there is enough of a sense of this being kind of an emergency bulletin from a very poor part of a very major city in America, and trying to portray what goes on in that world. That being said, this movie does have kind of, it's sort of one cliche after another, and such achingly on-the-nose dialogue as father figure character says to our main character, do you care if you live or die? Main character says, I don't know. Pay attention, audience. That's going to be important later. And there's a lot, and there's other moments that are kind of like that where they want to make sure that we get what is going on. I think, though, to be fair to the movie, this was not a movie that you could look and go, oh, well, there's 20 other movies like this. So it's such, it's, you know, you had mentioned Boys in the Hood. That's obviously kind of the precursor in terms of its setting and its world, obviously. But to watch it now is to think it doesn't entirely hold up. And the last thing I have to say that was shocking to me to watch was to go, I don't think any of the scenes in houses are in actual houses. Everything looked like a set. And of course, it's a low budget movie. And so I'm not going to ding them that hard for that. But it's a type of movie that was made on a low budget that doesn't entirely, I think, transcend the limitations of what they had in terms of, I think some of the directorial style that the Hughes brothers had, it's clear from an early age they knew what to do with a camera. But in other ways, there are things where it's very first-time filmmaker. There's some really kind of showy stuff in there as well. I think the movie still works, but it was one of those experiences of watching it and going, yeah, I was a lot younger when I first saw this. And in terms of what I expect from movies or in terms of what I've seen from movies, it didn't entirely hold up for me.
Yeah, and there's definitely an energy to it. And there's a sense of, you know, this is... Well, first of all, I'm going to take a step back. It's strange to think, by the way. I remember we've discussed, I think, on this podcast before, my interview that I did with Spike Lee for New York Magazine 3 or 4 years ago. And one of the things that we talked a lot about was how, like, there were at one time enough movies about, with all the different little angles that they came from it, enough movies by black filmmakers about young black people, young black kids, that there was a mock movie about them. Don't be a menace to South Central while drinking your juice in the hood.
Yes.
Like there was actually a Wayans Brothers funny, wow, there's so many of them. Let's do a funny riff on this movie. That's how many there were. And that is not happening now. That is certainly not happening to any stretch of the imagination. It has really not over the last 20 years. And one of the things I talked to Spike Lee about was that idea that why is it worse? Like why were there more movies about the black experience made by Hollywood 20 years ago than there are now? And he had a few theories as to why that was. I will say, one of the things that I feel like this movie hit me harder 20 years ago than it does now is one of the major takeaways from this movie is it really wants you to be, it wants to look like it cares. Like, you know what? This is what how it is. There'll be no sentimentality here. This is what it's like, and it's terrible, and it's hard. And on one level, I understand that, and I think that leads to like kind of its sense of purpose and the occasional sense of urgency. But I also feel like it feels like a little bit of a cop out.
Yes, I would totally agree with that. I would agree with that. Yeah.
And if it feels like ultimately, you know, it feels like anarchist in a way. With that, because it doesn't actually have that much to say, and I think there is a power to it, and there's no question there's an energy to it, and there are some really fun performances. To me, Jada Pinkett is awesome.
She's great. Like, yeah, she's the best
absolutely
part of it.
Great in it, and to see her now, to see how different of an actress she is now, I actually saw her on Gotham, and she's like playing like this Eartha Kitt, way over the top. She's having a blast. But to me, like, you watch Jada Pinkett in this movie, you're like, oh, she's a star.
Yeah,
like
she pops off the screen.
She absolutely pops. She absolutely pops. But there is a lot of this that does feel. It's funny you bring up the part of that made by people that were very young. A lot of it doesn't really feel that well thought through.
It just sort of seems like this would be a cool scene. This we have to have this. We have to have this. We have to have that.
Yeah, to the point where it feels more derivative than necessarily something that feels real.
Right. And I will say, though, watching it this time, the thing that stood out or is most interesting and made me wish there was more of this, though, of course, it's, you know, 22 years ago, the idea of the one character who's Muslim and the debates that he has with the other guys, that to me is actually some of the most interesting stuff in the movie. And maybe because it's, you know, we now live in that post 9/11 world, that stuff I found to be much more interesting and really wish that there was more of that. as opposed to sex scenes that, I'm sorry, look like music videos. And of course, the Hughes brothers got their start in music videos, so you can understand why. It is a bummer to watch a movie that was in my top five that year of 1993 and to watch it now and go, yeah, this is no longer a what I would consider a great movie.
This feels in a lot of ways like a rough draft for filmmakers that, given the opportunity to expand on ideas that are in this and to build off of that and to do more from that, could have done something really great. The way that, say, a Scorsese did, like, it's not a one-to-one thing, but like Mean Streets is a good movie, but he clearly took some of the things he did in Mean Streets and expanded some of the themes and some of the techniques and made them into larger things. And unfortunately, that's really not the opportunity that the Hughes brothers were given.
Right. And it's also kind of, and this is talked about, whether it's African-American filmmakers or minority filmmakers or women filmmakers, where it's like, okay, well, that one didn't do very well. What will you do next? It's like, no, that was your chance. Like,
yeah,
that was your chance. And this is a thing that happens over and over again. Of course, at the time, Menace to Society wasn't a massive hit, but it was a big, critically acclaimed, and, you know, I don't know if Spike Lee had this as an answer, but this also very much feels like a time where, ooh, hip-hop is a big deal. Kids are into hip-hop. And so, and there's a hip hop soundtrack on Menace to Society, and so you also have like Juice, or then Singleton's follow up film Poetic Justice, where there's this idea, it seemed like at the time, of Hollywood saying hip hop is really in. We should make more movies that incorporate that because it seems like the kids are into that. And so I think that also probably kind of helped make more of these movies because it seemed like a bigger kind of groundswell. Watching this now, it very much feels like a time capsule of the early 90s. And I think there was so much of a desire for the starkness of this movie and this idea of it not being romantic the way that Boys in the Hood kind of is in certain ways. Like, that movie feels more like a Hollywood movie in a lot of ways. And this one feels much more like an indie. This type of movie that, in retrospect, you know, we have 22 years of hindsight to help us out, lucky us. But you watch it and you think, this is the start of a career. What happens next? And it just never, they did Dead Presidents. They made From Hell. They did their documentary about prostitutes that almost didn't get a release at all. And that was, and the momentum kind of ended after that. Kind of heartbreaking to see this movie, I have to say. It's still good, but to have it not be as great as I remembered it,
it's a bummer. Man, stop giving us early 90s movies that we admired when we were young to people. Good. Still good. Like, for the record, like, it's not like I found this an unpleasant experience, but I did remember it more fondly than I felt watching it today.
Yeah, this is very much in the, we never do grades, I realize, for the reboot, but this is like in the B- category for me, I have to say.
Yeah, as opposed to how excited we were back when we originally saw it. So, all right. So that is Menace to Society. So thank you, reviewer, for giving us that one and ruining so much of what we loved about movies when we were in high school. Thanks, pal. All right, the next reboot movie is Being John Malkovich.
There's a tiny door in my office, Maxine, and it takes you inside John Malkovich.
There's no such thing as a hole into somebody's brain.
Yes, there is. You see the world through John Malkovich's eyes? And then after about 15 minutes...
That's not me. I didn't say that.
You're spit out into a ditch on the side of the New Jersey Turnpike.
It was amazing.
Where the hell are we?
Being John Malkovich is directed. Came out in 1999. Directed by Spike Jonze. Written by Charlie Kaufman. I believe, was this Charlie Kaufman's first produced script?
I believe that's correct.
I believe it was, yes. And Spike Jonze, of course, at the time, was known as this great music video director. I read a little, the movie stars John Cusack and Cameron Diaz, Catherine Keener, Orson Bean, very entertainingly, and, of course, John Horatio Malkovich. Not his actual middle name, by the way. That's a middle name they made for this movie. But, of course, he is playing himself, John Malkovich, Malkovich, Malkovich. Of course, the famous idea of the film is that John Cusack plays what I did not realize until I watched it this time and did not get when I saw it initially. I mean, he's basically, like, is he doing a David Foster Wallace homage? Like, I didn't...
I didn't even think about that. Maybe...
I mean, he's literally wearing a bandana. His hair looks exactly like him. He's a tortured artist that's constantly, like, he's certainly not, I don't think there's any way that Craig Schwartz is even a millionth as talented as David Foster Wallace. But there is a part of me that wondered, is there some sort of homage going on at all? Because he really, like, there's a lot of, or David Foster Wallace saw this and like, hey, that's all dressed. But anyway, regardless, Craig Schwartz plays this puppeteer who is very frustrated with his career and takes this kind of dead-end job where he discovers on the 7th and a half floor of a nameless, sad New York City skyscraper a little door that takes him into the mind of John Horatio Malkovich. And all sorts of madness ensues. It's funny because you and I, we love Kaufman. We love Kaufman. And I feel like you have actually liked Kaufman's movies more each one, correct? Yeah. And culminating with Anomalisa, which I think you are. We're both extremely fond of, but I think. Do you consider Anomalisa as the best movie that Kaufman's been associated with?
Oh, by a wide margin, I would say.
By a wide
yeah.
margin. Okay. So going back and watching this, I want to talk a few things about it because I loved this movie initially, and I still think it's very good. But a few things popped up for me. Craig is an asshole. And I think we always knew, like, it's not like he's supposed to come across positively. But I did, I mean, I just didn't remember him, like, literally pulling a gun on his wife and making her get in a cage. Like, there are, like, little, and then not really suffering, like, immediate consequences in the plot of the movie about it. Listen, a lot of, in all of Kaufman's movies, they all kind of have this guy at the center. This kind of sad set guy who is insecure and is focused on his art, but also feels like this is all kind of meaningless and has kind of this streak to him. And I feel like this is a first draft of that character. I did not remember as funny. This movie is like much more punchline funny than anything Kaufman or Jones would do afterward. Like there are, like there's obviously the absurdism, a lot of absurdism, but there's a lot of like straight, we're going straight for laughs in this movie that I did not remember as much. It felt more absurdist. So I enjoyed the movie a lot, but I will say, my personal favorite is still Eternal Sunshine. That is my favorite Kaufman movie. This feels as good as it is, as fascinating as it is. It still feels like to get us back to the kind of the Menace Society idea, someone starting something that they'll be building on as opposed to like the first out of the gate, nailing it perfect.
That in terms of directorial efforts, Anomalisa is great. In terms of overall script, I think Eternal Sunshine is the best thing that he's done. I had almost no memory of this movie and I can't help myself. I saw this movie opening night in Los Angeles. And Tarantino was sitting three rows ahead of me. And I was thinking at that time, oh, this must be a big deal because Tarantino is here. Like if he's seeing it, then it must be like some sort of big event movie that's worth kind of checking out.
Yeah, that's very 1999.
Oh, yeah. He was just like, hang out, go to a movie. You know, like he was like with his buds. Everything you said about this movie in terms of Kaufman's trajectory, I think is totally true. But I also say it's very true of Spike Jonze's movies, even more than Kaufman's movies in a certain way, though they've collaborated on two things together, this and Adaptation. Spike Jonze's movies are always populated with sad sacks. They're always the center of his movies. And so watching it in terms of both of their careers as they've evolved was really kind of fascinating to watch. For me, there's two main big takeaways. The first is Catherine Keener, what's up? I have to say, I have been a big fan of Keener's for a long time. I think she's a fabulous actress. This was a Catherine Keener I had forgotten about.
Yeah,
where I'm like, everybody's kind of a jerk in this movie, except for Cameron Diaz. Like, she's kind of the nicest one in the group. But Catherine Keener is such an awesome jerk in this movie and sexy as hell. I mean, she is so fabulous in this movie. I thought, my God. And going back, I realized that she'd been nominated for Best Supporting Actress for this. You know, she's done lots of great things, but there was a part of me while watching it this time that I thought, I wonder if this is the movie that Judd Apatow said, oh, she would be great in 40-Year-Old Virgin. I mean, she's not like the sexy character in terms of the love interest in that movie, but I wondered, because she's so sweet in that movie and so appealing, if there was any crossover that made him sort of think of that.
She's got a little Linda Fiorentino less seduction thing.
That's a great way of putting it, Will. That's actually such a fabulous way, because there is a sense of, she just doesn't care. She doesn't care. She doesn't step on anybody. Doesn't bother her, which is massively appealing.
If you have a problem with it, fuck off.
Yeah. And I think that works so well in this movie. The other thing that was a real takeaway, and this actually was like the sense memory feeling I'd held on to like 16 years or 17 years since I'd last seen this movie. This movie doesn't entirely know what it's about. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But watching, I'm like, I'm not sure if this movie, there's a lot of things it touches on. Celebrity, the idea of the actor's craft and the tortured life of an artist, whether it's a lame puppeteer like the John Cusack character or an established celebrated actor like Malkovich. There's this idea of identity, controlling people, the puppeteer thing. But there's also this kind of weird thing about what constitutes a soul, what's inside of us. And when the movie is over, and the ending is much more upsetting and dark than I had remembered, I have to say, I walked away from it going, I'm not sure if this movie exactly knows what it wants to be about, but it just keeps swirling these ideas and kind of like playing with them. Like there's something about Kaufman that is that his movies are not about one thing. And I think that's why I love Anomalisa so much. I can't define what that movie is, Anomalisa, but it touches something that feels very kind of deep and true when I watch it. And watching this, I was thinking, yeah, this is kind of where it all started. And then one more thing I have to say, sorry. Carter Burwell, you know, because the LA Film Critics gave him our prize for best score last year for Anomalisa and for Carol, I did the presentation last year. And so I went back and listened to a lot of his scores. And I thought, boy, his music is just so tremendous. And so I was kind of attuned or to paying attention to it. His score is really, it's very sort of spare, but it creates part of the sense of that there's something sort of deeper and richer going on. It's not just sort of this like weird, surreal comedy about people going into John Malkovich's head, that there's almost like an existential crisis going on in this movie. I'm not sure if this movie entirely adds up to a lot, but while you're watching it, it really does make you feel like, what the hell is this? There's no movie out there that's like this. Now that both of these filmmakers have kind of gone on and had careers, you get used to them in a way. But especially back in 1999, this felt like, what the hell is this thing?
I actually don't like a lot of the celebrity stuff in this movie. I feel like it's not quite. It's fine. There's some funny stuff. It's not as sharp. It frankly doesn't really feel like Charlie Kaufman's that interested in it. But it feels like maybe Spike Jonze feels like it is. Like one of the great jokes, of course, is that when they originally made this movie, the New Line said, why can't we just call it Being Tom Cruise? Can we just make it Being Tom Cruise? In that kind of idea, why do we have to, like, why does it have to be someone that is so kind of oddball and not as popular? I feel like some of it is like the idea that then he, what do you think of the fact that when Craig becomes John Malkovich and becomes this world class puppeteer and like Sean Penn shows up and talks about his brilliance. I don't think that stuff's that hot. Like I feel like that's like a show business satire thing that I find a lot less interesting.
It's probably not the strongest element of the movie. It doesn't bother me necessarily. You know, in terms of Malkovich playing himself, in terms of actors playing versions of themselves, this is one of the better performances. And I think what I really like is that Malkovich doesn't make the Malkovich character a stereotypical pretentious ass. There's actually much more, there's actually a certain amount of sympathy that movie has for him as an actor.
I also like when the guy on the turnpike pegs him with the beer can.
That is like, awesome.
Suck, Malkovich. That is great.
That, thank you for reminding me. That is such a great laugh in that movie. It's such a great, like, what? Like, I think I just hate John Malkovich, I guess. You know, both of our reboot movies are from filmmakers who started off as video directors. This movie feels a lot less like a guy who made music videos, except for the fact that it's kind of, there's some like trick shots and gimmicky shots in certain ways. Gimmicky is maybe a little too strong, but there's more of a trick shot thing
It's more of a look what I'm doing.
Yeah. But in terms of the two movies, I think it holds up a lot better. And Cusack, I think, is also really, though he is a jerk, I do feel bad for that character. By the end of that movie, I do feel something for him, which is not an insignificant achievement, I think, in that movie.
Well, all right. Well, Being John Malkovich, listen, it's Being John Malkovich. Go see it. But frankly, let's just take this opportunity for us to be talking about Being John Malkovich. Go watch Anomalisa, people.
Yeah, I, of course, could not help when Being John Malkovich opens with a puppet show. And I thought, oh, Right. Anomalisa. Yeah. Yeah. Anomalisa is terrific. We both love it.
Yeah. You will not be unhappy. All right, Grierson. Good show. Well done. I'm pleased. I'm proud of us. We did all right. Also, I want to mention, I listened to another New Republic podcast that's by Brian Buettler. It's very good. But he did something that we have not been doing that I've made me feel like I'm a terrible person. At the end of every podcast, he thanks Michaela Lefrak for producing the podcast and doing a great job. And she, and for the record, Michaela, don't cut this out, because she said the level of production that she puts on this show, it is, you have no idea. Each one of these shows are actually 11 hours that she whittles down to a 45-minute show. She is a brilliant producer. We'd be lost about her without her. So I feel like so remiss that we haven't been.
Yes, thank you, Michaela. Is great. Michaela, she is fantastic. Yes.
Next week, the big movie release is Finding Dory, which is, of course, the sequel to Finding Nemo from Pixar. So we will be talking about that next week. Our reboot next week, we have Road to Perdition and Armageddon. Not Gymkhana. Not yet. But it's coming. Hi, Christian. How are you feeling? Are you pleased? Are we ready to go home? Did we give Michaela enough to work with on this one?
This poor woman, the Purple Heart is coming in the mail, I swear. Yes.
Take care, everybody. Be safe out there, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right, bye.
Bye.